at the end of time, and the Mississippi River, she's a going dry. The interest is up and the stock market down, and you're only getting mugged if you go downtown. I live back in the woods, you see, my woman and the kids and the dogs and me. I got a shotgun, a rifle, and a four-wheel drive, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive.
If everything you eat comes out of boxes stored in your freezer, you might need the Self-Reliance Expo. If you're afraid to take out your own garbage because the neighbor kids might beat you up, you might need the Self-Reliance Expo.
Over 50 training classes are coming to the Self-Reliance Expo. This family-friendly event focuses on traditional values and long-forgotten skills. Gardening, alternative home building, off-grid living, food preservation, cooking with the sun, self-defense classes, canine demos, and more.
If you can kill a houseplant just by looking at it, you might need the Self-Reliance Expo.
The Self-Reliance Expo is fun for the whole family and is the largest of its kind in the nation. Learn how to do it yourself. Learn how to defend yourself. Save money. Save a life.
If the only screwdriver you own is made of orange juice and vodka, you might need the Self-Reliance Expo.
It's the Self-Reliance Expo, coming soon. Find out more by going to SelfRelianceExpo.com. That's SelfRelianceExpo.com.
Hey, old Dr. Bones here. Are you prepared to deal with medical issues in a disastrous situation? What would you do if medical help was not on the way? The Doom and Bloom Survival Medicine Handbook is over 400 pages of how-to advice written in plain English. You'll learn to handle all the likely medical issues you'll encounter in times of trouble. And it's not just a conventional medical wisdom. We talk about alternatives like essential oils, medicinal herbs, and other home remedies. Make the Doom and Bloom Survival Medicine Handbook a part of your survival library. And don't forget, Nurse Amy and I have medical kits, suture materials, instructional DVDs, and other items that'll help you keep it together even if things fall apart. Check them out, as well as 200 articles on medical preparedness, survival gardening, and other alternative remedies on our website at www.doomandbloom.net. Never think doom and gloom, think doom and bloom.
Hey, 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 welcome to Self-Reliance Exposed, brought to you by Backwoods Home Magazine, with Colorado Ron and Bubba DaVinci. Actually, this week, it's just Bubba DaVinci. We are actually out for the next three weeks, traveling, both of us. I am actually in Southeast Asia and China and in the Asian territories. And then Colorado Ron is out prepping for the Self-Reliance Expo in Arlington, Texas, which is April 26th and 27th. So we pre-recorded a bunch of shows so that way we weren't missing, and you guys weren't missing any really good information while we were out there. So we had an interesting phone call right before we decided to do this taping from our old friend Marjorie Wildcraft, the creator of Grow Your Own Groceries. And she had said that she was getting ready to travel to Cuba. And she'd like to talk about it. And my first thing was, why would you do Cuba? What does Cuba have to do with self-reliance? And she pointed out that the economic collapse in Cuba hit things a lot harder than the other economic collapses that we read about and we've discussed. As you guys know, we've talked about the economic collapse in Argentina and how that affected things, and we've talked about Greece, because that's definitely more current. And although both of those were devastating to the country and to the people who live in that country, those were primarily pure economic collapses. But in the case of Cuba, it was incredibly devastating because the government, including with farming and everything else, completely supported that country. And so when the government pulled out, and we're talking about communism basically disappearing and Russia stopping the support to Cuba, you had all kind. You have 11 million people going hungry, and you know you have riots and looting and killing and black markets popping up, and you know it's incredible. So Marjorie and a team of people decided they wanted to go over there and learn how the Cubans sustain themselves during these darkest times. And don't get me wrong, I don't believe those times are over by any measure. I think the country has definitely had an economic recovery to a large degree. But you know, Marjorie is going to go through that information with us, and I'm pretty excited to hear about it. I never would have thought about a place like that being hit that hard. Because I always think, yeah, okay, people will be out of money, so hyperinflation, everything else. But about farmers not having implements and not knowing how to grow properly and all the different things that you have to basically start from scratch on, that's a scary proposition. So let's go ahead and go to the pre-recorded interview with Marjorie Wildcraft. We call this Abandoned and Left for Dead. And these people may be your greatest hope. And it's basically the survivor stories from the greatest economic collapse, Cuba. All right, so we will go ahead and jump there, and we'll talk to you later. Good morning, Marjorie. How is everything at 6 a.m. in Texas?
It's good. It's good.
Well, I appreciate you getting up this early for us.
That's no problem. Is Ron on the line too?
Actually, Ron is traveling. We're both traveling, for the next couple of weeks. He's trying to get stuff done for the expo, and I'm doing China and Singapore and Thailand and kind of the Southeast Asian.
What are you doing there? That used to be my old stomping ground.
Oh, well, the company I work for now that we do, sounds kind of odd talking about a self-reliance show, but we do video games. And so I come over here and do contracts and set up things with the government and things like that. So I'm over here meeting with partners now.
Okay. I used to be based in Hong Kong. I lived there for 7 years and traveled throughout that whole region.
Yeah, I actually, with the exception of going from 20-degree weather to 98-degree weather with 100% humidity, I love coming out here. I prefer coming out when we're in summer and it's still warm out here, just because it's more consistent. But it's very difficult for me, especially during this time of year, to fly back and forth. I always seem like I'm right on the verge of getting sick.
Wow.
So Marjorie, you gave us you sent me an email about 2 months ago talking about this trip you were looking at taking to Cuba, and I have to admit, when I received it the first time, I was a little bit taken aback and thinking, why would anybody that's interested in self-reliance or, prepping look at Cuba as an example for anything? And then you sent back this email talking about, why you were doing it and everything else, and I was amazed. So tell us, why Cuba, of all places? I mean, can you give us some background on why Cuba? Yeah.
Yeah, why? I mean, who in their right mind, and who's even thought about Cuba in God knows how long, right? Ever since Ricky Ricardo and Lucille Ball. But Cuba is a fascinating case study for those of us. I mean, most people, and I just got done with a survey, most people are looking that economic collapse is the most likely scenario for America going forward. And look, let's face it, we're bankrupt, and it's just a mathematical certainty. Well, Cuba underwent economic collapse, and here's the story. When the Soviet Union came apart back in 1990, one of the consequences that nobody really thought about was that all of its major trading partners were suddenly cut off, and Cuba was a major trading partner for the Soviet Union. And Cuba, more than any other country in South America or Latin America, had embraced industrial agriculture. And so overnight, Cuba lost 70% of their fuel. They lost all of their chemical imports. They lost all their tractor and tractor parts imports. They lost all their food imports. I just, overnight, they just had their legs kicked out from under them. The buses stopped running. The lights went out. And everybody started getting hungry very, very quickly. They have 11 million people. How do you feed 11 million people when all of a sudden you're cut off? And the rest of the world didn't offer any help at all. In fact, the United States tightened its embargo, and there were articles in the New York Times talking about, well, this is going to be the end of the whole Castro regime, and this whole country is going to completely disintegrate. And in fact, that, you know, who knows, maybe that was why the United States tightened its embargo. But, you know, they were basically abandoned and left for dead, really. And they had, like every other country in the world, they'd sacrificed their local sustainable agriculture, and in their case for growing sugar and sugar exports. And the sugar that they were growing, you know, the price of sugar on the world market has been falling and falling and falling consistently as more and more countries use high fructose corn syrup and aspartame and all these other sweeteners. So the price of sugar has, you know, basically they lost their income. They lost all their support, and here they had nothing. How did they do it? So it's absolutely a pertinent thing for a prepper or a survivalist to look at and say, what did these people go through? What were the hardships? What were some of the parallels for our situation? And what are some lessons that we could learn from them?
Now, you know, you mentioned, so it was actually kind of a multi-tiered thing, because ever since the beginning of the Castro era, you know, and everybody remembers Bay of Pigs. Well, maybe most of the people here don't remember it, but they've heard of the Bay of Pigs and you know, all the different instances or issues that happened there. Because people don't realize Cuba, pre missile crisis, was a fairly well known resort country and a very, very high end agricultural country, putting out some of the finest cigars and weaved palm and all kinds of different things, and like you mentioned, sugar cane. And then they went dark, and what I mean by dark is they went communist, and then they basically got embargoed by all the countries with the exception of communist countries. And so they almost had to go into a system where they relied on government, because they didn't have the ability to do all the free trade that so many other countries nowadays just take for granted.
Yeah, and when the Castro regime came in, it did some good things, and it did some. I mean, you know, I don't really, I'm not really holding that up as a model of what we should be doing. By far, Castro was not the best leader on the planet. But they, you know, one of the things they did that was beneficial, though, is it. And you know, you're right about it being. I grew up in South Florida. And my mom used to tell me, you know, she never did it. She said, well, there used to be dinner cruises to Cuba from Miami. You'd get on a boat, you know, and you'd go down there and you'd have dinner and it'd be this whole thing, and then you'd come back. And it was a, you know, it was a pleasure place. It was a place where people, you're right, it was a big resort. And when I went there on this trip, you know, the old architecture there and the buildings there, you can see that this had been a place that had been very wealthy and very fabulous at one point in time. Although there had also been, with the Batista regime, you know, a lot of drugs, a lot of crime, prostitution, gambling, that kind of thing.
So it was Las Vegas.
It was Las Vegas. Yeah.
So I wonder if they had the slogan, you know, "What happens in Cuba stays in Cuba." I don't. We'll have to look that up. I don't know. So you know, speaking of travel, so you know, I was in the military for a lot of years, and you know. Cuba, as far as I know, has always been pretty much, well, not always, but you know, like I said, post Castro coming into power, has always been basically off limits, you know. And I knew guys that would go into Mexico or go into Canada and illegally take trips over there. So how did you get permission to go there, and was your trip, this is, hopefully this won't get held against you if you say, well, I went up to Canada. I mean, was your trip illegal?
No, my trip wasn't illegal, but, you know, it's a good question, and I love that book by Joel Salatin, that everything I want to do is illegal, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But this particular one was organized by the Organic Consumers Association on the American side, and they're the ones, it's Ronnie Cummings, and they have the Millions Against Monsanto campaign, and they could definitely use to grassroots. I mean, they really have some 800,000 people that they keep notifying of the things that Monsanto is doing, and they're obviously huge proponents of organic growing. That was on the American side. They were the ones that helped organize it. But this was a professional contingency of 26 organic farmers, organic food activists, and permaculturists that wanted to study the country. And it was a very, very intense 10-day trip where we were visiting farms, gardens, cooperatives, restaurants, different types of markets, the state market, the local, private markets, some of the more upper end, looking at the whole food creation and distribution and consumption system. You have to jump through some State Department hoops. You had to be a professional in the industry. The itinerary had to be completely booked. Technically, if you want to know, it's kind of fun. Americans legally have the constitutional right to travel anywhere in the world that they want to. So, technically you can go to Cuba. The way that the way our government enforces the embargo is they say, yeah, you can go there, but if you spend any money without our permission, it's considered trading with the enemy. And you're not allowed to spend any money when you go there. So as a group, we all had a license to spend money on necessities such as hotel and food and transportation, but we weren't allowed to buy anything that was not necessary, such as souvenirs or cigars or rum or any of the good stuff for why you'd want to go to Cuba, right? But it was a wonderful trip, and the focus really was, and I'm glad it was organized this way, because on your own individually doing something like this would be difficult, but they had the connections and they set it up. Really, we were going to all these different state-run farms and looking at farmers and talking to the local people about the situation. So it was not the fancy, nice hotel bus tour thing. We were living in a dormitory in the Martin Luther King Center, which was in a working class neighborhood, and we were visiting the people. So it wasn't a tourism thing, but it was all completely legitimate, which I'm happy to say.
Well, let me ask you. Go ahead.
I probably wouldn't be on radio shows talking about it.
Now, I have to ask. You said you stayed in the Martin Luther King Center, which is I find very, very interesting. So they actually have something named after one of our civil rights activists.
Well, revolution.
Pardon me.
Revolution and revolutionaries are one of the things that consistently came up in the Cuban trip. And they held the revolution, and their government has been working on, the propaganda to keep the revolution as an important thing. And in a lot of ways, Cuba was holding up that, hey, and it is quite amazing. I mean, really, they said they managed to kick out all these industrialists and all these imperialists, and they're a tiny country right next to a huge, powerful country. And they have managed not to get, sucked up or invaded or totally overrun. And they basically played the United States against the USSR. And they managed to succeed. I mean, it's pretty amazing that a small country could get away with that. So they really honored revolution. They felt Martin Luther King, had the spirit of revolution. The Martin Luther King Center was an NGO, a non-governmental organization, and they basically came in and they had these facilities and they did a lot of community outreach there, and it was supported and funded by a whole bunch of various ministries and private organizations across the world, as a way to help Cuba in some small way. So I still haven't totally figured out what their purpose was. They had dormitories and a cafeteria and all these meeting rooms, and that's where we stayed.
That's very cool. So I have to ask, now that you've gone over there and you've done part of the tour, maybe I'm jumping ahead, but we'll kind of start here. What do you see as the parallels in the Cuban situation that you see that are potentially possible if America were to undergo the same economic collapse? I know it's not a one-for-one, because the United States isn't under embargo, and people have the ability to, store things and do things that I don't believe the Cubans necessarily had the ability to do prior to Russia pulling out and just leaving them high and dry. So, but there's got to be a lot of similarities in the situation.
There are, and that's also one of the reasons for going on the trip. And the fascinating thing is where are things similar, and then where are things different? so it can help give us insights into when we undergo this journey. And some of the striking parallels are the United States imports right now, I believe it's about 62% of our oil. And Cuba had about 70, you know, they lost 70% of their oil imports. So let dollar collapse, that means we're not going to be able to afford to buy oil anymore. So the United States is going to have that same drop in available energy. The huge dependence on agriculture, conventional agriculture, Cuba was utterly dependent on large-scale farming that depends on tractors, it depends on fuel, it depends on chemicals. Well, the United States mostly, you know, is dependent on these type of things in order to produce food. And some people might say, well, the United States is food self-reliant because we, you know, we grow all this corn and all this soy. But that's actually not true, because we need imported oil in order to grow all that food. So the United States is going to be, and we also import quite a significant amount of food here, especially in fresh vegetables, seafood, and that kind of thing. So from the fuel standpoint, and from the food standpoint and the agricultural standpoint, you know, yes, we're looking at what will be a very, very similar situation. One of the differences that I feel is vastly important for all of us to look at is Cuba, when they underwent the collapse, it was a horrible, horrible time, and they're still really not out of it 20 years later, but things are much better. I mean, they've got, you know, the Cubans are gaining weight again, and, you know, things are moving along, but Cuba always knew that the rest of the world was still functioning. Okay, they've been knocked down and they're beaten down and they're going to have to figure out how to survive, but they always knew that things were rocking and rolling in America and things were rocking and rolling in Europe, and, you know, that there was a standard of living they could get back to. When the U.S. undergoes economic collapse, who in the world is going to help the United States? Who in the world could help the United States? There is not going to be the rest of the world rocking and rolling. There is not going to be some normal to get back to someday to hold out to look at for hope.
Wow, I hadn't even really thought about that. But you're right. If anything, it would be the exact opposite. People would be, you know, it'd be like sharks circling, you know, something, a seal that's getting ready to go out there. They'd be just waiting to sit there and see what they could take over, as opposed to probably giving us a hand.
That's, you know, and that was what you know, and who could? I mean, and of course, when we undergo collapse, just because everything is so interconnected, you know, who is actually, you know, China has, well, you know, they've got a whole lot of things going on too. They're not in some great, wonderful situation. They're utterly tied to the American economy, as is Europe and Japan and all these major players on the world field. When the U.S. undergoes economic collapse, this is going to be a worldwide global collapse. And of course, the U.S. does not have a whole lot of friends around the world.
Right.
That's because we have 10 times the military, right?
Well, I think that's a whole different show, because we could go into a whole different show just from taking that little piece and say, well, okay, there's, you know, the several big economic groups that would come in and start picking up things, and you can go on to all these conspiracy theories. But on who would pick up the pieces if the economic collapse happened. But I agree with you in principle. So let me ask you this. When I travel, including, you know, this trip, I'm really, really big, especially posting on Facebook, the second I get off the plane and posting photographs and everything else based on my first impressions, especially in a new country I go to. But, you know, a lot of these countries, and you said, you know, you've worked in Asia before, they evolve so quickly that you could only be gone 3-4 months and things transform and completely change. So I love having and getting the snapshot of my first impression as I step off the plane. So I have to ask you, what was your first impression? You've just gotten off the plane, you're leaving the airport. What's the first thing that hits you?
Yeah, so after you know, get through the throng of people that always seem to be hanging out at the outside of the airport, the very first thing that hits you when you get there is the old cars. They have all these old American cars that are somehow miraculously still functioning. So prior to 1959, when they had the revolution, you know, of course, they imported all kinds of American cars, and this was kind of a luxury town, and so there's all these, you know, Chevys and Cadillacs and all these, you know, I'm not an old car buff, but the people in the group were, and they're like, oh, I'm sure I had one of those, that was mine, that's a 1954, and they've managed to keep these things running, and they've had to, basically. But I talked to the Cubans, and they have such a wonderful sense of humor. I said, wow, how do you do this? They said, well, when you open up the hood, it's kind of like the United Nations under there, you know. They have, long ago, the original engine has, like, morphed into something that's made out of Japanese parts and European parts and Chinese parts and, you know, baling wire and duct tape and chewing gum and God knows what's holding that thing together and parts they've made themselves. But they're still running, and they're like half of all the vehicles that you see. And they've got a smattering of new ones that they picked up from, you know, during the Soviet era, and they're getting a smattering of new ones that they're picking up from China now. But, you know, by and large, like half of them are all these old cars, and they're just so funny. You'd be like, whoa, it's like jumping back in time. That's the first impression that you get when you hit Cuba. That whole theme of, you know, we talk about reduce, reuse, recycle. Well, these people, they live it to an unbelievable, you know, unbelievable level. For, you know, everywhere I went, I kept seeing example. You know, there's one place, and it was a building, and it was an old Winnebago. They had used the structure of the wall and the window, and then incorporated into the rest of the building. But this, they had a functioning window from these old Winnebagos, you know, or beer bottles. You know, cleaning and recycling and reusing the beer bottles over and over again. In one food cooperative we were at, they were using the beer bottles and they'd get this Corona bottle that was full of tomato sauce that they had made. And, you know, they're very, very conscious about hygiene. But, you know, a beer bottle, and let's think about it, that's a pretty indestructible thing you can use over and over again. And they did. You know, over and over again, there were so many examples. And, of course, all the agriculture, organic, sustainable agriculture is what works. And so that's what they ended up using.
That's very interesting.
As far as, yeah.
So, you know, in, I think a lot of countries that people don't get to visit, if you go through lots of South American countries and poorer communities out there, and you go to China, for example, into not the main provinces, but some of the outer provinces, I think you see a lot of the same. People, I think when it comes down to necessity, people tend to fall back to very, very common practices.
Yes. Yeah. It's true, and it's reassuring in some ways because, you know, all you need to do is, you know, get some basic skills on that and start to tune into that, and then, you know, you're going to be good. You know, it's going to be different, but you're going to be fine.
Right. So let me ask, okay, let me go into this. So I'm going to Singapore this trip. You know, Singapore is a socialized country, you know, social country. And, you know, Cuba was a socialistic country, right? So what is life like for the average Cuban? I mean, what's the difference that, you know, what are the differences going to be made on a day-to-day basis for the typical person who lives in Cuba? Because I can't imagine that Cuba has the same sort of socialistic system as a Singapore or a Sweden, which are both countries that use that system, but, you know, are much, much further advanced and further along, you know, by the grace of God. So, you know, what are we looking at as for the average day-to-day thing for a Cuban?
Yeah, no, Sweden and Singapore are both very, very wealthy countries. And, you know, in some ways they're a delight to visit because they're so clean and organized and the wealth is abundant and apparent. Cuba is a very, very poor country. And yes, they are very, you know, it's a socialistic or communist regime. On the whole, though, even though Cuba is very, very, very poor, compared to a lot of other Latin American countries that are poor, you know, the average Cuban is doing way better off. So the average Cuban gets each family gets a ration book, and every month they can buy basic staples and necessities, and it's nothing too fancy, but at least, you know, it's what you can survive on. They get this ration book, and they've got your basic rice and beans and soap and, you know, some eggs and whatever the state has, of the vegetables that the state has that they distribute. So everybody's got a basic amount of food. everybody's got health care. And Michael Moore just recently did a documentary called Sicko talking about the health care. And, you know, Cubans actually got pretty good health care. Like, 24/7 on almost every neighborhood, there was a little pharmacy. Actually, we were having fun going to the pharmacy and getting stuff. We couldn't bring it back to the U.S. But, you know, it was like 10 cents for this bottle of honey and propolis, which is, you know, a $40 bottle in the United States. And so really, really inexpensive and fairly good medical. So you get your food and your medical. Everybody has a place to stay. There's really no homelessness in Cuba. Talking to the different Cubans, they say, well, you may see one or, you know, you may see a little bit of somebody living out on the street, but that's really, they have a home to go to. That's just their family kicked them out for, you know, alcoholism or whatever, you know, some family that sees going on. Everybody has a home. And it may not be that great a standard of living, but, it is a roof over their head. And the fourth thing is education. You know, the Cuban government has been really, really big on educating. They're one of the most highly educated populations in Latin America. One of the statistics is although they have 2% of the population, they have 11% of the doctors. So very, very highly educated population. So, you know, the average Cuban really has a pretty good situation going on. They're close, you know, all the basic needs are met very, very simply. And you can say, well, you know, the average Cuban only makes about $200 or $300 US a month. Well, they don't need much more than that to live. So it's actually a fairly good situation for the average Cuban.
That's very interesting. I mean, because I do a lot of travel. I have an office in Singapore, and I do a lot of travel to Sweden. And people always ask me, well, how have they prospered and things like that? And I said, you know, it's odd. If you talk to, I work with government officials in both countries, and they say they're at about their max capacity as a socialistic country. Because I think, socialism works to a certain degree when you have, when you can control a lot of a small population, you know, and a small amount of land size, so the diversity is not, even Singapore is finding that so much business and everything is getting there that it's starting to get a little bit out of control, and the government's trying to figure out, you know, how do you take care of all these people that are coming into the country, because you have Malaysia and all these different countries around here who are coming in and want to get into the system. And so they have to put up mechanisms to create those checks and balances so it doesn't tip over. Now, Cuba is fairly unique in it's got natural boundaries that won't allow that to happen.
Yeah, that's true. And they are very, that's another thing about Cuba. They're very aware that they're an island nation. And they really know this, and I've experienced this when I've traveled to other places. Like when you go to Hawaii, you know, the people there are pretty aware that there's limited resources, and this is what's happening. You know, you're not gonna get away from anything. You can't run from the West Coast to the East Coast in the United States and have some anonymity or something. You know, although that's disappearing here too, but there is a sense of here's the resources we have, One of the things that struck me, and I don't want to like highlight the socialistic system or the Cuban government as being anything that wonderful, but that government genuinely seemed to have a much higher level of interest and care in its people than I would say that the U.S. government does. You know, they genuinely seem to be doing things that were helping the people by and large. And we know that the Cuban government has also done some horrible things. So I'm not wanting to get anybody too incited about it. But by and large, it's still a small country, and the people have a strong voice in how things are run. And they still, you know, have when the people have some control and some say and some input into the government, there's a very different feeling in relationship with the government. So and they were also aware of all the propaganda and nonsense. And we do know that after the revolution, of course, the first thing that you do when you get into power is you kill anybody who's a dissident or anything. So I'm not saying it's the perfect place.
Right.
It's a very different feel. A very different feel there.
So let's talk about the government. So when Cuba underwent the economic collapse, how do you think that their governmental structure helped or even impeded the situation overall?
Well, the first thing is by being socialists and having the ration cards, which have been in place since the first revolution in 1959, they already had a somewhat fair and equitable system for distribution of the supplies that they had. So that's one thing that helped them. So, you know, if we undergo a collapse here in the United States, you know, who's going to, you know, whatever food supplies the government has, if they're going to give it to us, how is that going to get organized? You know, there's a whole problem in itself, which Cuba didn't have that because they already had the state-run stores and the bodegas and the ways that they distributed food. So that's one thing that helped. The government, as soon as they realized this, they started, you know, saying, okay, well, we've got to start switching over our farming, and they started working on that. It took them a lot longer to get it going, but they had the power to say, hey, and I talked to some people who have been college students during the collapse, and they said, yeah, well, you know, they came and they said, everybody get on the bus, and they took all these college students and made them work out in the fields for a while to grow food. You know, you could never do that in the United States, you know. And I don't know if those people really wanted that to happen or not, but at least they could mobilize resources probably more effectively than what will be able to happen in the United States.
Well, I can't even push my daughter to go make her bed with nowadays with the laws without her being able to, not that she would, but it's like nowadays, the kid, you know, you tell a kid to do anything, you try to do it, and they threaten to have you thrown in jail or sue you. It's just, it's ridiculous. So, I mean, I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing to be able to, you know, to make people do their part.
Make people do what they need to do.
Yeah.
Under stress. Another thing, so most of the electricity was off most of the time, but they would have it on for, you know, usually a few hours a day, and they would have their state television, and they worked a lot to try and you know, keep the morale and the spirit of the people up, and they talked about solidarity. That was another thing that I saw over and over again, talking about solidarity and coming together, and, you know, they talked about the situation. They told people what happened and what was happening and why they were undergoing these difficulties, and they said, let's pull together and let's make it through this, and you know, the North Americans are wanting us to die from this, and, you know, turning it into, you know, and it's propaganda, but it's also helped people to say, well, here we're, you know, I'm suffering, but what I'm really doing is I'm fighting and I'm standing up against this big, bad, horrible North America, right? So, or this big, bad, terrible thing that's happened to us. So, you know, they worked their propaganda machines to have that happen, but it helped, you know. So, you know, I think that there were things in place that worked. The real way that they got through this, though, was the way that humans have always dealt with stressful times. And by and large, the initial salvation for the people was the people doing individual food plots in their backyards, working on their patios or on rooftops, or, you know, basically turning to their own self-reliance. Another fascinating thing about that population, you know, Cuba initially was a slave island. More slave Africans were imported to Cuba than all of the United States. I think some 1.2 million Africans were brought to Cuba to work in the sugar plantations. And so it has this base. And then throughout its history, you know, it has always had a plantation, you know, type. Even when the slaves were emancipated in the, I think it was the 1800s, there were still always these large plantations, and there was always a large population of working class people that were under some sort of dominion. And so when Castro went into socialism, it was also that type of situation with a government or a large controlling force over a body of people that still maintained a slave-type relationship or mentality. So, you know, that I think that also helped the government in being able to say, okay, we're going to do this now, and everybody mostly falling in line with that. So, you know, as I said, we're looking at the differences and we're looking at the parallels, and, you know, that kind of thing would not go over very well here in the United States at all.
So, first of all, I want to make sure, I want to throw in here before we keep going with questions, is that Marjorie is not either recommending or endorsing or anything else, you know, communist or socialistic government or, you know, doing things. The idea of this is to point out similarities and differences, as well as advantages and disadvantages of the way things happened. And so.
Yeah, thank you. Because I really am not. That's, you know, whenever I go anywhere, would I want to live here? No, I wouldn't want to live there. I would not want to live in that kind of a system. But under that type of situation, those things help them.
Right. As I've been going through this, I was thinking, this is going to be a great radio show because there's going to be so many people that are going, but they're socialist and they're communist. And, because people tend to overlook every type of governmental system has advantages and disadvantages. I mean, even dictatorships, one of the things you just mentioned there, it's no different than what the military does, which is you form a common enemy, which allows you to, anger and fear are great motivators and great sustainers. And so, the propaganda that's used and things like that, it creates a unified mob mentality that we have to survive, we have to do this, which get people through a lot of different things all over the world. That doesn't necessarily mean you want a dictatorship in your own backyard or a mob mentality, but people do what's necessary in order to survive. And so I think that's basically what we're pointing out here.
Very much so. Yes.
So other than the governmental structure that we've just been discussing, what other advantages or disadvantages, did the Cubans have that you noticed?
Well, for one, they basically have a tropical paradise, So in the wintertime, they don't have to worry about how are we going to keep these people warm. In the summertime, of course, they did have a problem how to keep them cool. But they have a four-season growing period. And they have, abundant rainfall. They have a lot of natural resources that North America is going to have some challenges when we undergo this, that, people in the north are going to have to figure out how to stay warm with systems and structures that aren't set up for any kind of sustainability. Whereas the Cubans were a lot closer to that, and they had a lot of natural resources to work with. So that's one of the biggest advantages, I would say. One of the other things is that Latin Americans in general, they're much more affectionate and feeling and touchy. It was just amazing, men kissing men and holding hands and, things that we would be totally offended by. And it's almost like the French, they're just so much more engaged with each other. The other thing about, so Cuba, you own your own home, but it's a socialistic country. You're not allowed to sell it. So what that means is that they have neighborhoods and the whole country is like a level of stability that we can't imagine. So you grew up in your home or your apartment, your parents grew up there, you've gone to school with everybody in the neighborhood, your parents went to school with everybody in the neighborhood, your grandparents may have. We've got generations of people that have all been living in the same neighborhood all together for at least the last 50 or 60 years. And when crisis comes, they're pretty well connected. It's not like, in America, we move every 5 years and we hardly know each other.
Marjorie? Hey, you hit like a dead spot or something. You're back.
Wow. Uh-oh. Okay.
All right, so you were saying that, just kind of go back to where we lost you on the recording, was that you were saying that everybody, has a, they've grown up with each other and they have this sense of, familiarity, I guess you would say.
Right. So you don't go out, when you know your neighbors that well, and when your parents your parents and everybody knows each other that well, when a hard time comes, when this kind of unbelievable stress comes, you don't start thinking about robbing or looting or killing, that just didn't enter their consciousness. Their main thing was, how can we help each other? And because they're so highly connected. And I think that was a huge factor that'll be different from here in the United States. Here in the United States, the average family moves every 5 years. We don't hardly, if you know a couple of neighbors in your neighborhood, that's pretty extraordinary, So I think that was another big factor that influenced how they handled that crisis.
That's very interesting. So I understand that you did a lot of interview with Cubans about their experience during this period. and we were talking about how passionate they are. So I have to ask, you know, what type of hardships did they undergo? You know, was there times of mass violence and riots and black marketing and illegal activities and theft? I know when Argentina collapsed, and talking to the people from Argentina, and anytime I've ever gone to Latin America and you go to an area that's had a lot of turmoil, it seems like this happens a lot more. And I think I always personally base it on passion, because they're passionate about their families, they're passionate about their families, and I know I would do anything to keep my family alive. And so, you know, what were the things that went on there during that period?
Well, as far as I can tell from the interviews that I did, there was not a lot of massive riots or violence. And I guess, and I go back to that, I think because it's primarily an island nation and they're so well connected, you know, it's really hard to have a riot in basically your own family and or in your own neighborhood when you've known everybody for generations. Black markets did come out, and there were illegal activities. But a lot of times what people felt were illegal activities was, at that point in time, you weren't allowed to have a second job. So some people would try to find a second job if they could, and that was considered illegal. You did infinitely better if you had a relative in Miami who would send you some dollars every month or every so often. So that began to skew the things. And, you know, it was just really, really extraordinarily difficult period. Suicide, I think, was a bigger issue than violence. And mental health, I spoke with, I had one really in-depth interview, and I'll have these up on the YouTube channel. We're in the middle of processing them now. But this one Cuban man, Alberto, and he was talking about how, you know, for a Cuban man or a Latin American man, it's a very machismo society, and he had actually delayed having his children with his wife for many years to make sure that he would have, you know, the resources to be able to raise them properly. And when this thing, and every year things had gotten better and better and better after the, you know, once the revolution happened, everything started, you know, they went through a bad period, but the things were getting better and better, and they always felt that the future was going to get better and better. So they had children. And then this economic collapse happens, and he can't feed his children, and he's totally hopeless, and he's helpless, and he's doing everything he possibly can. He managed to find some second work, and he's desperately trying, and he said, you know, I even gave the kids, you know, when I could get things, and the kids didn't want it, and they push it away, and they said, I don't want to eat that anymore, and, you know, he's totally devastated. He said he had a breakdown. He had a mental health breakdown, and he ended up in a mental health hospital. So there was unbelievable trauma and pain. And in fact, you know, many of the Cubans, it's called the special period, but that's what their government uses as the word. Most of the Cubans themselves say, we hate that name. We hate that name, special period, because it was extraordinarily difficult. And so there were cases, of course, of malnutrition showing up, usually in the children right away. Another woman, Lena, that I spent a lot of time interviewing, and she was talking about after a while the people's faces and their skin, you know, started turning gray and cracking because they weren't getting the fats and the oils that they needed in their bodies. And the whole, you know, the spirit of the people were just so sad and depressed and down. And she was talking about what kind of things could they do. Like, she was always trying to lift the spirits and keep things, you know, keep people more hopeful. So it was an extraordinarily difficult time. If you can imagine, you know, it gets really, really hot and humid there in the summertime, and people tried to maintain, you know, socialistic countries, they've got jobs, so they tried to maintain, to go back to their work. You know, they no longer could ride a bus or a car anymore, so they'd walk or ride a bicycle. But they're hot and they're sweaty and they don't have any soap to clean their bodies or their clothes. So the stench must have been horrible as they're still trying to maintain some sort of normalcy in their life. It was just an extraordinarily difficult time.
I find it interesting that you're saying that there wasn't a lot of violence or riots, because I remember very clearly how bad things got in the Russian bloc when communism fell. And, you know, when everything, when the food, you know, the people had, you know, weren't able to get around, like you said, and people were cut off and there wasn't the government support and, you know, people rioting and there being violence because, you know, they stood in line for hours and hours and hours and there wasn't enough to give it, feed everybody and do everything. And so I have to say I'm fairly surprised and very interested in finding out more information how they were able to avoid that, because it's just, it seems like human nature would dictate that if, you know, things went that direction, that violence is typically what ends up following.
That's really also what surprised me the most there, that it just really didn't seem to get that violent. There's a couple of factors on that. Again, the high level of interconnectedness, and the fact that there were a lot of natural resources that they could work with and do something. So people were growing food in their backyard, or I know, even though they didn't have a lot of room, people were talking to me about, you know, and they were still very embarrassed about this to this day, but, you know, like maybe raising a pig in their bathroom or raising some chickens in the bathroom or something like that. You know, there was a lot that they could still do. So I think that, you know, that also gave them something to focus on and work on, is their own backyard plot or their things. But and I don't know, I had a sense when everybody was talking to me that I was getting the straight story, but you know, I don't know how much we were handled while we were there. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and I was wondering that too. In the early days when I first started going to China and we were doing media, you know, they would have a person from the Ministry of Culture that would follow us around, and if someone started telling us something they didn't want to be heard, they'd cut it off. You know, and they always seemed to steer us directions where we were talking to the schools that said, oh, everything's fine and this is great and we do this and this and this. You know, and occasionally someone would sneak off and then go talk to someone else and go, oh, we're getting this story. So, yeah, I wonder, I agree with you. I wonder how much you were handled to give a story that it was bad, but maybe not as bad as it was. Number two, I wonder if a lot of the difference is what you said, that when you deal with a small socialistic country, you know, it's a lot easier. I mean, it's a lot more difficult to get away with things like that. I mean, in Russia, it's such a big area, big country, and even the cities are so massive that when things like that happen, people can kind of just blend out back into the woodwork. And a country like Cuba, where everybody knows everybody, you know, Puerto Rico is kind of the same way. I have friends that live in Puerto Rico, and they talk about when someone does something wrong, everybody knows about it. You know, it's posted in the paper, and every family knows about it, and they shame the family. So that you're very well could be the interconnectivity that you said was just enough to keep people from just taking it to that next level.
I feel the internet connectivity was really a huge, it was the biggest factor. And, you know, and I also have spent time in China, and I do know what it's like to be handled. And I think that people were a little cautious with what they were saying, but I don't feel it wasn't anywhere near as blatant as it was, say, in China, you know, 15 or 20 years ago. But, you know, and I think people are still a little careful about what they say. But interestingly enough, I just couldn't find any kind of statistics or figures or anything about, you know, violence breaking out. And there were some protests and some things, but it was nothing like what you would expect in other, or what we've seen go down in other countries.
Very interesting. So, just as anyone would be, you know, marked or scarred by a traumatic experience like this, what do you see existing today that you would call scars, so to speak, of the experiences of that time?
Well, first of all, the infrastructure. You know, they're still a very, very poor country, and, you know, the sidewalks are crumbling and buildings are crumbling. Surprisingly, I did not see a lot of trash or graffiti, and so it seemed like they were, you know, there was a lot of civic pride in what they had. But, you know, buildings were in disrepair, or, you know, some of the buildings by the shoreline that had been hit by hurricanes, you know, it was going to take a long time for them to get around to being able to making those functional again. So, you know, the country is a very poor country. The old cars, you could just see them reusing everything over and over again. We did see some horse transportation in Havana, but not a lot. As you got out in the countryside, there was definitely a lot more. All of the food growing cooperatives that we went to, they used horse or oxen to work the soil, to do the tilling or the cultivating or the weeding. And all of the farmers that we spoke to had no desire to go back to tractors, interestingly enough. And this one wonderful permaculture activist in the neighborhood was saying, you know, we need to redefine wealth. She said, am I not wealthier if I have an ox that only needs grass and water and to be caressed? And I thought, oh, how lovely, you know. And there were some tractors, we saw them, but they almost never seemed to be using them in the fields. And it turned out you can work the soil under a lot more conditions of rain or muddiness with animals that you can't get a tractor in during those time periods. So, you know, in a way that's a scar, but it's also a really dramatic change. You know, the emphasis on local food production was very, very obvious. You know, throughout the city, there was in Havana, and then of course out in the outlying areas, there was, you know, dedicated acreage just to growing food in these food cooperatives that they had set up. And the focus on sustainable food production that is fully embraced by the government and all the people was very, very clear. And they really got it about food sovereignty. They really totally understood food sovereignty. You know, the UN defines food sovereignty as you're able to feed all your people. But they think you can do it with imports. And Cuba really got that food sovereignty, and you can feed all your people from your own land, which was a big, you know, that's a huge distinction and a huge learning curve. You know, there was just, you see a lot of people talking about the special period, and that's an embedded thing in their culture now, is this special period. And clearly, you know, They like anybody who's gone through traumatic, you know, cancer or you know, getting that phone call that you've got, you know, some terminal thing, you know, that has clearly marked them from that period and what they lived through. So there was quite a lot, and they have, as I said, fully come out of it. They're just now also starting to experiment more with more market forces. And having private businesses and shifting a little bit more to a market economy, so they've got a long, you know. And then will that ever happen? I mean, look, and then they were very interested when I said, you know, Americans are looking at economic collapse, and they're like, oh no, you know,
right?
What happens if America undergoes economic collapse?
Yeah, it's very interesting. Well, I mean, even China, you know, has now got their form. I call it capitalistic communism. You know, and I think at some point, you know, the government has to kind of look at allowing the people to start running their own businesses and start going that direction, because you can't. I personally don't believe that, you know, things can be sustained completely in a socialistic or communist forum. It just, I mean, even the socialized countries, both Sweden and Singapore, which I look at very successful socialistic countries, are, you know, the big government agencies will start as government agencies, like telecom companies, and then very quickly over a 4 or 5 year period of time take 50% of it public, and then, you know, and then start allowing the market share to start, the actual business market to start picking up, so the people can start supporting themselves. And help grow the local economy. So I think they're doing it the right way. Cuba seems like it was just be a fantastic case study overall for a lot of different things.
It really is, and they're just starting to dip their toe in the market economy, and that'll bring changes, and some of them will be wonderful, and some of them won't.
Yeah, I agree. So let me ask you this: you were talking a bit about food production and things like that. So how much food is Cuba producing for itself now, since they've realized that, you know, that they have to make sure they feel, you know, feed themselves? And additionally, since you said that when communism fell, the chemicals and everything had disappeared, have they gone back to that, or is all of it organically grown? Are they big farms, backyard farms? Just, what are they doing and how do they do it?
Well, currently to date, they grow about half of all their food that they consume. And by and large, most of that, I believe 80% of that, is grown on very small plots, so 3 to 20 acres with cooperatives. And they had a lot of cooperatives, and what they would do would have 10 to 100 people that would work this land cooperatively. And the deal was, is the government gave them the land and training and helped get them set up, and then they would have to give a certain quota back to the government in the vegetables and meat and eggs and things that they produced. And anything that they produced above that quota, they could sell in a private market, so they could set up a little food stand and sell it. And those were doing really, really well, and they're dotted all over the landscape, and that's the bulk of their food production. They did have large state-run farms out in the countryside, and oh, by the way, all of that is organically grown. It's all the local, small-scale stuff is organically grown. Right? So all the classics that you'd expect to see of, you know, intercropping, companion planting, you know, worms being used from rabbit manure, you know, growing worms, you know, all the different ways to use water, you know, cover cropping, all the classics that you would expect, because these things work, and they have worked historically, and that's what works when you have nothing. That's why they were doing that. Out in the countryside, there were large state-run farms, and mostly, from what I could tell, for export crops. So, for example, you know, bananas or tobacco. And you cannot run a large monocrop operation without using chemicals. So they did have some access to, they were buying some and using it now for these large state-run farms to produce, and look to me mostly like the export crops. One thing I was personally very disappointed about was that during the height of the special period, 80% of their food had been grown locally and provided locally, and it was mostly from backyards and small individual initiatives. But it's funny about human nature, you know, 20 years on, and as things have gotten better and the government's been providing them more with more food, and they don't necessarily need to use their backyard plots, they've given them up, and they're down to only about 50% of their food supply is locally organically grown. The government does have huge incentives, though. They if anybody wants to get land, they will give them land, and they'll give them training, and they'll help get them started. And there's this huge program to try and get people to grow food and to do this local organic food. And even, you know, during the special period, the way the whole social structure turned upside down, so, you know, doctors and lawyers are normally considered at the higher levels of the social system. During, you know, the special period, well, all of a sudden the lowly gardener who had been hired by the doctor to keep the lawn manicured suddenly now is the most important person in society, because that person knows how to grow food, and that turned around. And even today, a farmer or somebody wanting to get into agriculture just starting out can make 2 to 3 times the salary of a doctor or a lawyer. And on these cooperatives where they're able to sell the excess in the private market, you know, these people working, the farmers or the agricultural people, are making 10 to 20 times what a doctor or a lawyer would make. So there's a lot of emphasis, but for me personally, I was very disappointed to see that on the individual scale, when people no longer absolutely needed to be growing their own food, they dropped it.
So if large monetary incentives aren't getting people to grow food, you know, what factors do you think play into why there isn't a big rush to go into farming or into, you know, co-ops? Because, I mean, we see, this is a very, very, almost parallel to the United States, which is farmers are having to bring people in from Mexico and Latin America to come and try to operate farms here in the United States because they can't get the kids to want to go into the business. Now, the difference here is, you know, there is a lot of high-tech you know, basically low work, physical effort jobs that you can make good money on in the United States, which is not necessarily the case in Cuba. But, you know, is that a human nature thing, you think, that people just say, I just don't want to farm? I mean, what do you think?
I know. So for me, I was so mystified by this. And, you know, I mean, there's huge monetary incentives for young people to get into farming in Cuba. You know, it was amazing to me. And I asked a lot. And the two things that I came up with as possible reasons, and one is there had been such an emphasis on education by the Cuban government, and such an, and as I said before, you know, 2% of the population, they have 11% of the doctors in Latin America, and I still feel there was a stigma from, or the feeling that, you know, the more highly educated you are, the better, and that is, you know, they don't realize how much talent and education and intelligence needs to go into creating these food systems, but there's still that, you know, he's a farmer. You know, dumb farmer kind of, you know, there's still that perception of, you know, that's not an occupation that really requires a lot of capability. So there was the farmer stigma, which most of the world carries, and they certainly have a good dose of it there. I think the other factor that was in it, and this really is where the socialism hurts them, is, you know, I asked a lot of them, I said, why do you think people aren't going into this? And they're like, well, you know, there's two areas that anybody who wants a good job can get it, a good high-paying job, and that's in farming and in construction. And, you know, quite frankly, it's a lot of work. So, you know, when you've already got all your basic needs met, you got a ration book and you got a house and, you know, you can get a job doing anything and not really have to produce too much, I think that, you know, the lack of initiative that's basically been bred through that collective system, I think that also played into it.
Wow.
So I don't know. But, you know, for me, my passion and my mission is homegrown food on every table. And I, you know, I love growing food, and I think it's just so amazing, and the connectivity and the that you have with the whole cycle of life, and the challenge of it is, you know, the making these amazing permaculture systems. And the challenge of growing a lot with and using as little work as possible. I mean, these are the kind of things that I love. And I'm, for me personally, I left there saying, well, growing food, backyard food production really needs a marketing job. I mean, how can we make this, you know, not only for the Cubans but for ourselves? How can we make this more, you know, sexy or powerful or, you know, whatever we got to do to how do we bring out the absolute joy that it is? And make that. I've actually been thinking I might go up to the Olympic Committee and try to promote backyard food production as an Olympic sport or something. You know?
Right.
I didn't start the thing around, you know.
Right. That's funny. So okay, let me. We have to get ready to go here. I appreciate all your time. So did anything really shock you during your trip? Any experience that just, you know, kind of rocked your world or just said, wow, I can't believe that that's the case?
Yeah, this. So I was doing all these interviews with the Cubans about the special period, and at the end of every interview, and I would do my best not to lead them into this, or you know how you can cue things up sometimes, I would really try not to bias them in any way, and at the end of the interview, I would ask them, what advice do you have for Americans who are preparing for economic collapse? You've lived through this horrible experience. What advice can you offer for people who are preparing? And what really, really got me by the end of the, when I left the trip and I started to go through those, and you don't get to use that word gobsmacked anymore. I mean, but man, was I gobsmacked when I realized that not a single one of them said anything about buying stuff or stocking up, you know, getting all your food together or buying bullets or, you know, storing up medical supplies. Not a single one of them said anything about buying stuff as a preparation. They all talked about, you know, being prepared to share what you have or being prepared to work with your neighbors or being prepared to adapt and change or being prepared to try and invent games and invent ways to bring up the morale, you know, learn how to sing. You know, they had all these suggestions, and not a single one of them had anything to do about buying anything. And it really hit me how they are just not a consumer culture.
Right. No, but I think that probably plays a lot into it. I think that we as Americans always take the easy road. It's what, how do we buy ourselves out of it? And we do that with the government too. So I think it's bred into you.
I don't want anybody to hear that I'm not advocating. I believe you should have at least a year's supply of backup food, and it's prudent to have some weapons and some ammunition in storage, and it's prudent to have some medical supplies. You know, homesteaders here a century ago would not even think about going out without having backup food supplies. The Native and Indigenous peoples in the United States, like the Hopi, for example, had at least 2 years of food supplies because they had regular droughts. So, you know, I don't want anybody to say, well, she's saying don't go buy food. I think that that's the thing. What really struck me about the Cubans was that just didn't enter their consciousness as a solution.
Very interesting. So, Margie, let's take a second and talk. Let people know how they can get your Grow Your Own Groceries products and give them your website real quick.
Yes, growyourowngroceries.com. And I'm all about how do you, you know, the simplest, easiest, fastest, funnest ways to grow food and do it during a situation when you can't get to the grocery store, when everything's closed and things are falling apart. How do you produce your own food? That's going to be the most important thing, is being able to eat. So growyourowngroceries.com. It's two DVDs and a CD with a library full of books that supports it. And it's all about, really, I'm really about helping people to prepare and be able to have the skills they need to be able to shift into this new lifestyle, into this transition. And believe me, I got into it from fear and panic, but now I love it. I wouldn't go back. This is so incredible.
Very cool. And you'll be appearing at the Self-Reliance Expo during the Arlington event. Any hope out there to getting you up to Iowa during June? I know you're so damn busy.
Yes, and wow, that's Iowa. That's a long ways. Let me look into that. But in Arlington, I will definitely be there, and I'll have a lot of images from the Cuba trip, and we'll be going more in depth into some of the interviews that I did with people. And it'll be the visuals really bring home how the whole Cuban experience.
Great. So we've been talking to Marjorie Wildcraft, the creator of the Grow Your Own Grocery series, and talking to her about her experiences in Cuba. You're actually calling the topic for the show and calling it Cuba, Abandoned and Left for Dead. These people may be your greatest hope. So thank you very much, Marjorie, and looking forward to seeing you next month in Arlington.
Yes, thank you so much for having me on.
All right, you take care, and we'll talk to you real soon.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Hi, this is J. Stephen Stoller for Backwoods Home Magazine. If you like the program you're listening to right now, consider subscribing to Backwoods Home Magazine. Call 1-800-835-2418 or go to www.backwoodshome.com and click on the subscribe button. Every issue of Backwoods Home Magazine is over 100 pages, packed with solid self-reliance advice by experts who tell you how to survive in these unpredictable times. Call 1-800-835-2418.
All right, welcome back to Self-Reliance Exposed, brought to you by Backwoods Home Magazine. We were talking to Marjorie Wildcraft, creator of Grow Your Own Groceries. I want to make sure before we sign off for the day that we make sure you understand that we don't endorse socialistic or communist setups or countries. You know, we're not endorsing the methods that were necessarily used in Cuba, you know, whether it's dictatorial or propaganda or things like that in order to get things done. And as Marjorie said, she's definitely not endorsing the fact that you do not store food or be prepared. What she was doing and what we were doing was giving you the experiences of how things actually happened in a country and how they dealt with things and overcame adversities and everything else. It's obviously going to be different in every single country. So although I already know we'll be getting lots of emails and things posted on Facebook, you know, saying that, you know, well, socialistic countries don't work and everything else. We are not talking about the political aspect of Cuba or what happened. It's just a necessity of the conversation to get to the points on how the people survived and what they did and how they are now. So Thank you for joining us for Self-Reliance Exposed. We will be on next week with another pre-recorded segment, and we will be live at the Arlington Convention Center April 26th and 27th. As always, you can go to www.backwoodshome.com to get your magazine subscriptions and find out anything about the magazine. You can hit us on Facebook at Facebook.com/BubbaDaVinci, Backwoods Home, or Colorado Ron Page. So keep prepping. Good luck. Be good. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
We're from North California and South Alabama and little towns all around this land. We can skin a buck and run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive.